Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have something special in store for you today. We're going to do a question and answer session because, well, we don't have any phone callers like we normally do on the weekend edition of Health Talk, but we do have questions, and the questions come to us in a variety of ways. They come to us via email. They come to us especially through radio program at AOL.com. That's the email for questions. Also, if you want to subscribe to our great Intelligent Medicine newsletter, radio program at AOL.com. If you have a question, you can email it to us. So we won't guarantee that we're going to answer it during the podcast. And, of course, I can't endeavor to answer each and every one of your questions. And if you pose us, you know, general question on Facebook, I might answer it. But if you pose, like, a whole medical dilemma, I can't do it on Facebook because, well, it's just not legal to exchange medical information in a public forum. Besides, I don't think you'd want your confidentiality breached in that fashion. We all have to be kind of careful about Big Brother and the NSA watching us. So with us and laughing in the background in response to that is our Hoffman Center nutritionist, well known to the vast majority of you. She is Layla Mudin. Layla is a registered dietitian. She also has a master's degree in nutrition, and she works with me on a daily basis, seeing patients, providing them with nutritional support. We take a team approach at the Hoffman Center, and I do the medical end, and Layla does the nutritional end. And she is, by the way, she is available for consultation. Some patients see me and Layla as part of a team approach, and some patients just see Layla. It's actually very much more economical. If you don't have medical insurance or if you don't want to undertake a big expensive workup, you can see Layla on an individual basis, and she absolutely shares my knowledge base, and we consult on all the patients that we see together. So, Layla, it's a pleasure having you on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast once again. And we're going to do this as a regular feature because, frankly, I need help. I need help fielding this huge volume of questions that I get, and I get tired of talking. So we're gonna use you as a regular here on the Intelligent Medicine Podcast, and I'll tap you frequently to join me. So
I look forward to that. Thank you so much for having me on, Dr. Hoffman.
It's a pleasure. So, oh, by the way, before we get into questions, you did a great little short feature on MSG in our Intelligent Medicine newsletter for this week. And so tell us a little bit about what you had to say about MSG. It's you know, a lot of people say, well, they go to the Chinese restaurant and they say, no MSG, and they think, no, that's fine, I'm covered.
Right. Well, MSG, monosodium glutamate, can also go by a whole lot of other names. And what I've been finding is that even though a product, say you go into the grocery store, will say MSG-free, if you look at the ingredients, it's very important to read the ingredients because MSG isn't always called MSG. It may be called natural flavorings. It may be called hydrolyzed vegetable protein. It could be called autolyzed yeast extract. And it goes under a guise of a lot of different names. So for those who are bothered by MSG, who actually have a reaction, whether it's GI distress, whether it's headache is one I hear frequently. I'm sure you do too, Dr. Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
So for people who have to watch for the MSG, you have to be aware that it can be caused a lot of different things. And it can be in a can of soup. It doesn't have to be just in that bouillon. By the way, did we know that bouillon normally carries monosodium glutamate? So this is actually a flavor enhancer. MSG gives a meat-like flavor to, or the umami taste buds. We
right,
have salt, sweet, bitter, all of that.
Right. This is an interesting thing because it's kind of like the discovery of like a new planet, because we know the basic tastes, you know,
yeah.
Sweet taste, salt taste, you know, they're different receptors.
Sour, bitter, and... Mm-hmm.
Right, different receptors on the tongue, and they can actually localize them. Some are, you know, more for sweet taste, and so, you know, and they, you can actually recall experiments you might have done in junior high school or high school where you put a drop of salty water in different parts of your tongue. You don't taste it until you go right on the salt receptor, and similarly for sugar, you know, there's only parts of your tongue that sense it. But then they discovered, and the Japanese actually were pioneers in this, because it turns out that some of the things they used to use in food, like soy sauce and bonito flakes, were particularly rich in a substance that made food really, really delicious. And so being great food chemists that they were, they came up with a way of synthesizing in the factory, and lo and behold, we had MSG became a huge multi-billion dollar industry. We started flavoring all kinds of foods with it because MSG makes everything taste better, and it also makes foods highly addictive too, doesn't it?
It does. It does. It does make us crave more, unfortunately. And this is where we have to be careful if we're trying to shed a few pounds or trying not to gain any more weight or to stop craving in general. It's not a coincidence that an hour after we eat Chinese food, we still want more, or some other kind of flavoring, or in whatever processed food you had.
It's not so much that they gave skimpy portions. That used to be the old joke, you know.
Right.
Because I remember, I actually am old enough to remember the introduction of Chinese food into America, because a lot of people just take it for granted. But when I was a kid, you know, like a really small kid, they didn't have a lot of Chinese takeouts.
Is that right?
This is an interesting sidelight. I don't know about New York. I grew up on the West Coast.
Uh-huh.
But there was this new, really cool thing in the 1950s and 1960s, which was Chinese takeout. And it was like you got it in those little cartons, right? You know, the little white cartons that fold. And but the joke, and it used to be, you know, Johnny Carson would tell these jokes on The Tonight Show. It's, you know, variations on the theme of that an hour later, you'd feel really hungry because the thought was the portions were skimpy. It was designed for Chinese people who were used to eating rice and very light vegetarian food. But then they got smart. They laced the food with all kinds of fat and heavy grease, and that, you know, got it to be better for American palates. But, yeah, interesting, you know, sidelight. The MSG actually makes you crave more. It goes, it kind of is like a direct impulse into the taste center of your brain.
Yeah.
And it hyper-stimulates it. There's some people who are concerned about the negative brain effects of MSG.
That's true, too.
It's an excitotoxin, and
An excitotoxin. It also hastens gastric emptying.
Yeah.
That's why we're hungry sooner, because the contents have moved down or indigestion in process. So when our stomach is empty, it's time to eat.
And you've actually given me a heads up. Sometimes, you know, I'm really busy taking a medical history, for example, with a patient who has GERD or reflux. We have a ton of those patients. Sometimes I don't have time to go into their diets in detail. Then they go down the hall, they see you, and you do your detective work, and you come out excitedly, and you tell me about all the MSG that a person is eating. And then thereby, by eliminating the MSG, sometimes the GERD problem, where people have been on acid blockers sometimes for years unnecessarily, is solved because it's pure and simple MSG irritation of the esophagus.
Yeah, yeah. So it's wonderful when we find that out. It's like, hey, Dr. Hoffman, this patient's been using adobo on everything.
Right.
You know, or something, or are heavily into processed food. It will be mostly in a lot of processed food, some herbs, seasonings, spices, sauces, gravies. These are the places to look. But we should always question my favorite term for MSG, which is natural flavoring. What in the world is that?
Yeah, I always look for that on labels, and I'm amazed by the frequency with which that appears. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so a lot of people think, okay, look, I'm holistic. I don't shop at the supermarket anymore. I just go to natural food supermarkets. I buy natural, organic food. Everything is clean, no chemicals. Is that 100% insurance against getting MSG in your food?
It can be. It can be. It's a pretty good bet, possibly.
Okay,
but we're in a restaurant.
Actually, I have to say that I've seen in, you know, some of the chips, for example, from Whole Foods, there's hydrolyzed yeast products, there's natural, quote, natural flavorings, things that give something a barbecue-y or smoky flavor. Sometimes these things do contain MSG or variants. Okay, so that was good. So let's go to our questions. So I have this person who asked me a very specific question on Facebook, and I said, well, you know, I can't answer this on Facebook, but I tell you what, I'm going to copy the question, and we're going to answer it on our Intelligent Medicine podcast. So here goes. This one's from my Facebook friend, Jamie, who's a gal, writes, what is a plaque score of 216 in the LAD, that's the left anterior descending article, of a 59-year-old, very active male, who's a builder and plays tennis most days of the week, bike riding, hiking, 5'10", 163 pounds mean? Well, you can see this is a very specific question. She says, at first, cholesterol is about 245. But then later in this post, she goes, oh, wait, I checked the cholesterol. It's actually 300. But the HDL was something like 89. So it was a high cholesterol, but it was a good HDL. So the question is, bottom line, would a statin be indicated? And, oh, by the way, can you reverse plaque through diet? And, oh, she adds additional information. This, you know, a lot of information here. She says, and presumably this is her guy, her husband or boyfriend. He is a huge fan of sweets. Now, keep it, this guy's active. He's 5'10". He's 163 pounds. He's relatively young. He's 59, but he's got a plaque score of 216. So let me handle it a little bit from the medical standpoint, and then I'm going to flip to you. Mm-hmm. What does it mean when you have a plaque score of 216? Okay, so evidently, these folks may have taken my advice or their doctor's advice to get a coronary calcium score because, you know, you can look at cholesterol till the cows come home. It sometimes has very little relationship to the degree of cardiovascular risk, as is indicated by the amount of calcium that forms in your coronary arteries. So, okay, you do the test. It's a simple test. It's relatively inexpensive. It simply measures the amount of plaque that you have in your coronary arteries. And the scores can range from zero to into the several thousands. Now, the only really good score is a zero score, or maybe a score that's like a 7 or a 9 or an 11. That means there's fairly limited plaque. A score of 216 is not super high, but it pretty dramatically increases your risk of cardiovascular disease, either in the present. I mean, it's not that likely that with a score of 216 you're going to get a heart attack tomorrow, although that's possible. But in a 59-year-old, this guy's going to be around for a long time, and that score tends to go up, on the average, 20% a year. So wouldn't you like to have a bank account that would go up 20% a year?
Absolutely.
You start with $216, and in 10 years, you could have like $2,000, right?
Right.
I mean, I don't even know what the math is on that. Uh-huh. But so this guy, frankly, is at risk, and in spite of the fact that he's active, he's slim, something's wrong with us. But I think the clue here is the diet. And Jamie says he is a huge fan of sweets.
That's so, a very, very big clue.
So take it from there.
Yeah, okay. So being a huge fan of sweets, first of all, let me start by saying a lot of heavy-duty exercisers believe they can eat anything they want.
Thank you for saying that. Thank you.
Yeah,
for
heavy-duty exercisers will say, well, I could eat all the pizza I want. I could eat all the French fries I want.
They're
carb loading, or I could eat all the ice cream I want. That's, you know, I've heard people say, well, I run marathons, so I'm allowed to eat a pint of Haagen-Dazs anytime I want. So, but the problem with the carbohydrate loading is subsequent rise in blood sugar is going to cause a rise in insulin. Insulin is pretty much a master and commander of inflammation in that it can take that cholesterol and oxidize it and make it form that sticky plaque, and this is where we can run into a problem. And that's really one of the things. So we can't eat anything we want. We have to, everything, food is information, as we say in integrative and functional medicine. What we put in this pie hole, okay, is going to cause all kinds of hormonal cascades, starting with our digestive juices and so forth. And what we eat will determine whether we will become more inflamed or in a disease process or not, or the other way, anti-inflammatory. And that has to do with the quality of the food, number one. Number two, the amount of sugar, because we're finding out more and more that sugar is pretty much a poison. It's toxic. And too many refined carbohydrates, as white flour, is its first cousin. It behaves the same way in the body. Anything that will cause a rapid rise in blood sugar, insulin subsequently will have to come out and normalize that blood sugar. But too often, because we're eating so many carbohydrates all the time, that insulin will overshoot and cause our blood sugar to crash. And now that insulin is out, not only is it hanging around causing inflammation, mostly in our coronary arteries, the arteries in our brain, in our pelvic area, everywhere, in our limbs. But it's also keeping us in fat storage mode. when insulin has done its very important job of normalizing blood glucose levels by ushering the glucose into our cells, into our organs to be used for energy, any excess glucose will be stored as fat. And folks, there is always excess glucose if you're eating this way. And it's always going to be stored as fat. It doesn't matter that you're going to go run 3 miles tomorrow. You're still in this fat storage mode. Would it not be better to not do that and be in a fat-burning metabolism all the time? That can help to reduce inflammation in the coronary arteries. So what
type of diet, say this is a guy or a patient, what type of dietary approach would you recommend for optimizing his cardiovascular risk?
First, we want to look at, we have a total cholesterol, right, Dr. Hoffman? I want to know what his triglycerides are.
Right. His cholesterol is around 300, which is quite high, but the HDL is high, so sometimes we don't know. We actually see some patients where cholesterol is high, but HDL mitigates that. In this case, though, the tiebreaker is the calcium score, which shows that something is going on there, that the cholesterol is having an adverse effect, despite the fairly good HDL.
We also have to look at the other markers. We have to look at homocysteine.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly one. We have to look at lipoprotein little a. We have to look at high sensitivity C-reactive protein. These are other very important markers of inflammation. And you so standardly do the Shield test to see what kind of oxidized LDL cholesterol may be present. Mm-hmm. So that's a test we have to look at all of this.
What that test does is it breaks down the LDL to show which LDL is the more dangerous oxidized type of LDL. I mean, there's also large and small particles. It gets complicated, but when we do a cardiovascular assessment, it goes way beyond just cholesterol and HDL. Now, the question I'll field here is, would a statin be indicated? Because that's a medical question. That's the question I would answer in the office. The answer is maybe, because, hey, this is a guy who's at risk. And I think that this is a harder question to answer than for many other patients, where we might see cholesterol numbers are high, but they have very little plaque. When we see plaque developing, one can ask the question, will statins offer a protective effect? If statins are well tolerated, they don't cause problems, maybe. Very often patients have problems with statins. A guy who's exercising might experience a good deal of fatigue. He's a bike rider and hiker. He may have muscle aches that make it impossible for him to tolerate a statin drug, and then we'd have to go to another type of treatment. Maybe we could use some red yeast rice, which is better tolerated than a statin. Mm-hmm. And then, I'll leave it to you. We have a whole panoply of nutrients and supplements that we might use to prevent cardiovascular disease. We know this guy's at risk, so we've got to go full court press. So why don't we name and enumerate some of the supplements that would offer some protection?
First of all, even though with all the terrible press it's been getting, fish oil is certainly one.
There you go.
As a powerful anti-inflammatory. Things like CoQ10, especially if this person would have to take a statin, CoQ10 can help, carnitine can help, D-ribose can help with muscle recovery if this person is particularly athletic. These are all helpful. And certainly all the antioxidants are maxi gamma E, more doses of vitamin C. There's still more investigation that would need to be done, and I would be looking at what this person is eating every day on a regular basis. And I also want to know this person's hemoglobin A1C, their fasting glucose, even a 5-hour glucose tolerance test, what their insulin levels are. This is key for me. When I see there's too much insulin floating around in the circulation, I know that I have to have this patient or this person calm down on their carbohydrate intake.
Well, say this guy is having, we don't know, but say this guy is having a standard American breakfast. Maybe he's having cornflakes or frosted flakes with skim milk and some fruit on top, with a glass of orange juice, a cup of coffee with sugar, and maybe he has a little bit of a cheese Danish or something with it.
Can you believe people still eat this?
I mean, typically, and I think we're kind of shielded from it because, frankly, we practice in New York. I think people are pretty astute about that. You don't see that many people eating like that. But man, you just leave the sophisticated urban enclaves, and you're in middle America, and first of all, you've seen a lot of really overweight people, and you look at their shopping carts, you see what they're taking home, and then, you know, you see what people are eating in the restaurants, and oh my God. So, you know, I mean, our patients, the vast majority of them are pretty sophisticated by the time they get to see us, but so what would be an alternative to that?
And an alternative to that might be, well, it could be an omelet for breakfast, and I don't mean egg whites.
Perish the thought. Eggs? Don't they kill you? Don't they immediately, the fat from the eggs goes in your arteries and clogs it up? The cholesterol, you know, goes to your, immediately to your coronaries?
Well, here's the thing. The good news is that nutrition is not as simple as plumbing. Therefore, the cholesterol in our food does not become cholesterol in the body or continue to behave as cholesterol in the body. Our livers make 80% of the cholesterol we need. Therefore, when there is, and it also works on a bit of a negative feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
When our body or our liver senses there's enough dietary cholesterol floating around, it will make less, number one, having it behave more normally. The cholesterol in our food, the saturated fat in our food, does not cause our cholesterol to go up. There is enough scientific research, and there has been enough scientific research for many years now, that are showing us that too many carbohydrates and sugars are directing the liver to make more triglycerides to cause the LDL not just to go higher, but to make those particles small and dense and much more atherogenic. And we've seen over and over that when we put a patient or scientific subjects on a lower carb, higher fat, higher protein diet, the cholesterol issue, for the most part, normalizes, and even more importantly, inflammatory markers normalize. Now, Dr. Hoffman, we see this a lot. We'll put the patient on a diet, and then they will go running back to their cardiologist and get their cholesterol and everything checked, and it's only been 3 weeks into the plan. It takes a good 10 to 12 weeks or 3 months for our biochemistries to normalize. And now I really make it a point to tell the patient, don't go running back to your cardiologist to see what your cholesterol is next week. That's not really going to tell us anything. Check it in 3 months, and then we're going to take it from there. You know, it didn't take overnight to cause the abnormalities in the biochemistry. It's not going to be overnight to fix it. So an alternative breakfast then for this person would be definitely eggs, an omelet. Maybe it could be some other kind of protein, some vegetables, maybe some avocado and walnuts, maybe some leftover salmon.
This morning I came back from working out. I'd taken a long swim in the pool, and the first thing I did was I took a half an avocado, put a little bit of olive oil on it, and you know, I just ate it straight up, you know, as a prelude to the breakfast. So
yeah.
Which were eggs, by the way. I had three eggs, but they were medium sized, so they weren't that. They weren't the jumbo eggs. So.
They weren't the jumbo eggs. that's really an excellent choice. And eggs are like the perfect protein to compare all the other proteins to. So, you know, again, natural, whole, unprocessed food, the way it's found in nature. Speaking of looking at people's grocery carts, Dr. Hoffman, and you could often tell when you see an overweight or metabolic syndrome-y or obese individual, you look at their grocery cart at your local Stop and Shop, and you see, wow, they've got boxes and boxes of food in there. Boxes meaning everything is processed.
Yep.
Nothing really came out of the refrigerated aisle or the produce aisle or even the frozen aisle so much, unless it's like a lot of frozen TV dinner type of things, another source of MSG, speaking of that. So, yeah, it all starts with changing the diet to see how we can normalize the biochemistries. And I think then, Dr. Hoffman, you would also agree that when we've tried everything with the diet and the person has really been doing everything well and being completely compliant, and it's still not getting the biochemistries to where we need it to be, then you have to go and prescribe a statin. Absolutely. You know.
And I might mention, you know, as you were reeling off supplements, I thought of a couple more. Things that could be used for cardiovascular prevention. Resveratrol, very important.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, that's the red wine connection. And it actually turns out that if you drink red wine, it does confer some protection. But even if you drink grape juice that has resveratrol in it, or take resveratrol in a concentrated form in capsules, you'll get some protection. There's evidence on green tea, curcumin, kaolic aged garlic extract is one of my favorites. Of course, there's the vitamin D connection. We're very excited about the potential for vitamin D to reduce cardiovascular risk. And actually, I just read an article, which just came out today, quite interesting article about vitamin D in relationship to heart attacks. Now, this article, in the past, they've shown that vitamin D can prevent heart attacks. But in this article, they actually looked at people who had heart attacks, and they looked at the level of vitamin D that they had in their bloodstream. And what they found was that even if you had a heart attack, the heart attacks were milder if they had higher levels of vitamin D. So, you know, not 100% protection to have adequate levels of vitamin D. Nothing is a perfect bulwark against all misfortune. But, you know, if you have a heart attack and you have fish oil on board, and if you have adequate vitamin E and vitamin D and magnesium, you know, chances are you might survive your heart attack and have less permanent damage to your heart muscle.
Yeah.
So that would be important. And then there's vitamin K, of course. There's the
Vitamin K.
Yeah. The
very overlooked.
Yeah. Well, tell us about that.
Well, vitamin K helps to keep the calcium in our bones rather than forming calcifications in our coronary arteries, maybe even forming calcifications elsewhere, like in soft tissue, like in breast tissue or something like that. Vitamin K is very often overlooked, and one of the supreme sources of vitamin K, besides a supplement, is our dark green leafy vegetables and, believe it or not, meat.
Meat and even cheeses, although many people have dairy intolerance.
Yeah, even some cheese, right.
Yeah, so, I mean, the initial study that got people excited about that, I mean, they noticed a correlation between wine consumption and cardiovascular protection. That was the so-called French paradox. Then they came up with a Dutch paradox, which is that the Dutch consume a lot of the, you know, they're big experts on cheese. You know, they have this Edam cheese and all these really fatty cheeses, and yet they had lower incidence of cardiovascular disease when they looked at the Dutch who consumed more cheese. And what they found was there was the protective effect of the vitamin K that develops when you ferment the cheese. It has to be part of the fermentation process. So anyway, so that's a lot of information for Jamie and for her guy. The final question here is, can you reverse plaque through diet? And I'll, you know, we'll both answer that, but let me take a crack at it. What I've noticed when it comes to coronary calcification is I don't like to do a lot of subsequent tests. Once you've established that a person either has or doesn't have plaque, you know, maybe you can check every 10 or 15 years, get a report card, but it's not the kind of test like a bone density that you might do every year or two. There's radiation associated with the test, and it doesn't tell you that much. It is unlikely that with diet or with even chelation therapy, which is very good for reversing cardiovascular disease, that that score will improve. What you can do is you can slow the progression. So I have patients who come in, say, in the example here, that this person has a 216, and then 3 or 5 years later, they excitedly, you know, come back for another test, and we take a look at it, and the result is it's 240. So they go, they're disappointed. They go, oh my God, you know, it's gone up. What did I do wrong? Why isn't it better? And the answer is, in that period of time, if you hadn't done anything, you might have a score of 5, 6, 7, 800. And so a slight increase is actually a good sign. You've held the line on increase. Now, that your cardiovascular risk can improve dramatically when you have the same calcium score. So say you start out with a score of 1200, which is a high score, puts you at high risk for cardiovascular disease. Does that mean you're going to inevitably get a heart attack? Well, you might. But if you follow a dietary approach like this and take the right supplements and protect yourself, it's much less likely that you're going to have an event. So, you know, it's not just about the numerical score for calcium. It's about the characteristics of your circulatory system, whether your blood vessels are stretchy, whether there's inflammation causing sticky plaque and attracting platelets to narrowings.
And or if the calcifications are stable or not.
Yes, it's the whole notion of what's called stable plaque. I mean, frankly, you know, we could all go to our graves at the age of 110 with a, you know, a three-digit calcium score. That probably is natural, but, you know, succumb to just old age and not a premature heart attack. So, the natural state of man is perhaps to accumulate a little plaque, and woman, you know, don't want to be sexist about it, but you still can overcome cardiovascular disease even with a moderate score like that.
Yeah.
So, So there, I think that's a pretty comprehensive answer. You want any add any points to that?
Just from the nutritional standpoint, from the diet standpoint, the main objective is going to be to get rid of that inflammation, so no more plaque will accumulate.
Right.
And that would really be the aim of an eating plan.
Okay.
And a supplement program for that. So sure.
Okay, are you ready for a simpler question?
Sure.
I think we need to take a break from that very serious predicament. And this is from Linda. And Linda writes, she actually wrote this to you. I don't know how it got to me. Oh, I'm sorry. It says it's from Linda, but it's signed Sandra. Okay, whatever.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah. Dear Layla, I eat Greek non-fat plain yogurt every morning with fresh blueberries. I have no health problems whatsoever. I am 68 and take no medications. Should I stop the yogurt? Thank you, Sandra, or Linda, if you prefer.
Sandra or Linda, you can continue having non-fat yogurt with your blueberries. That's perfectly fine.
Right.
I also happen to know that with Greeks, yogurt.
Yeah.
Because
what's the deal with Greek yogurt? I mean, it's like
it's more protein because that yogurt's been strained, so it's actually more dense.
Okay.
And what I keep finding out.
Why is it it's such a sensation? Everybody's going for
this. Because it's so creamy and wonderful.
Oh, okay.
It's so, because of the density, it's creamy and wonderful. And that way,
And wonderful when it's non-fat?
Well, there's the thing. Because it's been all the liquid has been taken out of it, it's more dense. So it's got some more protein in it. So even with the non-fat version, it's still creamy. And really, you could use as a point of reference the full-fat version is very, very creamy and rich, even to the point where some people say, that's too rich for me.
It's like creme fraiche or something.
Almost. Yeah, it can be.
You stick the spoon in it and the spoon stands up.
It stands up, exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
So, okay, but what is this brings up a couple of points. You know, first of all, I mean, it sounds like it's fine for Sandra.
Or Linda, yeah.
Or Linda, I can't figure that. And she has it with her fresh blueberries, which is a great idea because, you know, one of our bête noirs, one of our pet peeves at the Hoffman Center is the people who eat flavored yogurts, right?
Yeah, that's yogurt with jam.
You put in like jam, which is sugary. So if you're going to put something in your yogurt, just get plain yogurt and then add the fresh fruit and don't add sugar, right? Okay, so that's one point to be. And by the way, it's having a dose of blueberries every day, it's like getting, you know, extra vitamins. I mean, it's a marvelous supplement. It'll help your brain. There are a lot of benefits to blueberries. I try to have blueberries whenever I can.
Blueberries a superhero, absolutely.
So what about whether people should have non-fat yogurt, skim milk, low-fat dairy products? Because look, you look at all the American Heart Association recommendations. They say have plenty of low-fat dairy. But they always say low-fat because, God forbid, you should get any fat from your dairy.
Right, fat is still a demon.
right.
Saturated fat is still a demon.
So what's the take on that?
Barring anybody with dairy allergy, number one, first of all, they should avoid all dairy. And certainly anybody with lactose intolerance should also avoid all dairy. Do we as human beings?
Wait a minute. Lactose. You can have yogurt if you have lactose intolerance.
Many people can. I have a minority of patients who still have trouble in that area, but
it's a matter of degree.
It is because so many of the live cultures already digest the lactose, which is helpful.
Right.
Now,
explain the difference between dairy allergy and lactose intolerance. People have a lot of problems with that.
Yes, yes. Lactose intolerance means that our intestines don't secrete the enzyme to help digest lactose, and that enzyme is lactase. So those of us who don't secrete enough of that enzyme to digest lactose wind up having that crampy, uncomfortable, bloaty, and then soon after diarrhea because that lactose is not able to break down and digest. That's what lactose intolerance is. It's having not enough lactase, that enzyme. Now, dairy allergy is an immune response. That means when you eat that particular food, it's triggering your immune system to respond to that, and any time our immune system is triggered that way is a source of inflammation.
And what sort of problems can that entail?
Oh, it could be anything from skin eruptions to GI upsets to hives to anything.
Headaches, arthritis.
Yeah, headaches, arthritis, all of the above. Constipation.
Certainly asthma, phlegm.
Earache. Oh, yeah.
Right, okay.
A lot of people get congested from dairy. I don't know what you think about this. I think it has less to do with allergy, except that dairy is just a mucus maker for so many people.
Right.
Sometimes that is allergy, certainly.
Right.
It could be both. You know, actually,
okay, so,
I'm not sure.
So what about, now you have this culture clash among people. There's two groups in the high protein diet movement. Both groups believe in plentiful fat and plentiful meat. It's all going to be natural. But you have a group of people who are proponents of the paleo diet, and then you have the people who are the proponents of a high protein diet but with natural non-pasteurized dairy. They're big fans of the dairy, and these guys they're like hitting each other over the head, because the paleo people are saying, oh, we have no business having dairy after the age of one or two, because no animals in the animal kingdom consume mammal milk after they've been weaned, and yet you have the other people who say dairy is fine as long as it's natural, unpasteurized, raw milk. That whole
right. Well, I think a lot of traditional diets, like is often touted at Weston A. Price about the raw milk and things like that. There's a lot of good cultures and raw milk and kefir and the fermented products like yogurt that are actually beneficial. But it is, however, also true that, you know, we're the only animals on the planet consuming dairy products when we probably should have stopped after we've been weaned. Do we need dairy as human beings? Probably not. I don't think we need it at all, actually.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of different strokes for different folks. Because we help a lot of people out by eliminating dairy products, because on the basis of tests or on the basis of trial and error, we notice that it makes a big difference. But I don't think there's a hard and fast rule about
And one diet does not fit all.
Right. I think maybe that's what Linda or Sandra is after here, because she's saying, in principle, should I stop the yogurt because it's bad to have dairy? I think that's the question lurking behind the question here. And the answer is, you know, we don't know. If you're fine, you're doing great, no problems, and,
yes,
you know, we do an IgG RAS test or some other comparable allergy test. And by the way, no allergy test is perfect, but at least we can get a heads up on this. And, you know, it should be fine.
I could think of one more scenario where it would not be fine, and that would be for somebody with any kind of autoimmune illness, rheumatoid arthritis, Hashimoto's thyroid. Casein and autoimmunity, there's a very strong association. Casein is the protein found in all animal milk, which is all dairy, goats, sheep, as well as cow, and all of that. And I think that would be another case where I would eliminate dairy.
Multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis or something like that, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because that's what we do in patients who have autoimmunity. We take out the, quote, modern foods or the foods that might have an irritative effect. All right, so one other consideration, you know, while we're at, because it's amazing, this little question actually brings up a whole lot of issues. The relationship between dairy consumption and certain forms of cancer. There's actually some concerning evidence about the relationship between dairy consumption in men and prostate cancer, and in women in relationship to breast cancer. And so can you comment on that?
Yes. Well, here's the other thing. Dairy, let me just speak of the original dairy, mother's milk, right? We've all had some, hopefully, if we've been okay. Contains a lot of insulin-like growth factors, IGF, all of that. This is very, very beneficial for a brand new infant, a growing baby, maybe even a toddler, a small animal, et cetera, et cetera. But what happens when we continue consuming this? What is this insulin-like growth factor doing? Dairy, all forms of it, is very insulinogenic, meaning it causes us to secrete a lot of insulin. It does cause a lot of that same blood sugar insulin response for those growth factors, and we have to wonder, we have to ask the question, what is this growth factor doing to us who have already grown and all of this, and Is it growing a tumor? Is it growing a cancer?
Right.
Is it causing the cells to become immortal and transform, which is what cancer cells are?
And
it's a very
good
question.
Oh, that's a really good point. And the other point to be added to that is, you know, there's natural milk or organic milk, and then there's milk to which there are all kinds of additives, including BGH, which is bovine growth hormone, which makes the udders of cows swell, and it increases milk production. That's great for the farmer and for their bottom line. But what is it doing to the milk? Are there residues of that that get into the milk? Does this growth factor have a growth promoting effect on maybe the tiny cancers that lurk in the breasts of many women or in the prostates of many men? I mean, we just did a study looking at men who died in their 80s and 90s, and they found that virtually all of them had small areas of prostate cancer that didn't kill them, but, you know, were there nonetheless, were sort of kept under wraps. So, you know, that's a concern. Also, the potential for pollutants to find their way into milk, because animals eat the grass. The grass may be contaminated with PCBs, pesticides, herbicides,
Roundup,
you know, and then it... And then ultimately it gets concentrated, because milk is a concentrated product. Cheese is an even more concentrate of the already concentrated milk. And boy, that's high on the food chain. There's a lot of potential hazards to using those kinds of products. I mean, so there's a lot of controversy that swirls around that. And, you know, I hope that Linda or Sandra is not extremely confused by our very long discussion of this. And folks, that's all. We didn't do too well in terms of answering your questions, but we have some additional questions. It took us a long time to answer these questions, but it was very interesting. So we're going to return with more visits with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin as we tackle some of your questions. We invite them, radioprogram@AOL.com. And a reminder, as a final note on the Intelligent Medicine podcast, the podcast is not sponsored. There are no commercials. It comes to you free of charge. But it takes time and effort to produce these podcasts. And so a little bit of a pitch for you to help to support these podcasts. No, don't send us dollar bills in envelopes or gold coins. But patronize the Hoffman Center website. Go to drhoffman.com. And check out our fabulous array of products. We have a wide array of the products that we talk about here on the Intelligent Medicine podcast. And we invite you to browse in our store and check out our prices. And we offer a price challenge. If you find a product there that is advertised elsewhere at a better price, just send us the URL from the website where the product is. We'll match the price. That's our commitment to you. So help keep this broadcast on the air. And although, you know, it's a labor of love for me, and it certainly is for Layla, we want to continue doing this for a long time in the future. Thanks very much for joining us, Layla.
Thank you.
And I'll see you in the office.
Terrific.